How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by my good friend, Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Herring. Chris, the Philadelphia 76ers are dead. Luka's legend is alive. Celtics-Bucks is giving me chest pain. The Grizzlies without Ja Morant might be the best team in the history of the NBA. Happy Friday the 13th, my friend. How are you doing?
Damn, I didn't even know it was the 13th. I'm good.
Are you shook?
You having me on as always. No, I'm not shook. Just was unaware. So I looked up immediately at the corner of my computer screen. I was like, oh shit, it is the 13th. I did not realize.
Just a wonderful day. On today, let's just get right into it. There's a lot of basketball to discuss. On today's show, we'll be discussing Thursday night's pivotal franchise-altering Game 6s, quickly previewing Friday night's pivotal franchise-altering Game 6s, and opening up the mailbag. But first, a quick reminder to please keep your emails coming, openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. All right, Chris, let's start with Heat Sixers. Miami eliminated Philadelphia last night, 99-90. That score really doesn't illustrate it, how lopsided this one felt. But before we talk about the game and these two teams and what's going to happen in the future, I just want to have like a quick little preamble caveat type of situation. I just want to say that even though I would have still picked Miami had Embiid been healthy, the fact that he wasn't kind of makes all the noise, all the blame game talk pretty dumb to me. Like, the Sixers weren't beating the number one seed under these circumstances. There's a reason Embiid was an MVP candidate. Like, I don't care how well or how poorly Tobias Harris or James Harden or Tyrese Maxey were playing or what adjustments Doc Rivers could cook up. Who he wants to give backup center minutes to. Like, all of it is just so irrelevant if Joel Embiid is not Joel Embiid. So I just want to get that out front before I start to burn the Sixers to the ground. Not to be reductive, but, like, my read on last night's game was just, like, one team was playing hard and the other team was not playing hard. Is that like a fair way to just like look at that game, or am I being unfair and obtuse?
No. I mean, it's, I don't even think it's really worth, it's crazy too. Cause like you look at the final score and it was a 9-point game at the end, but it doesn't feel like it was worth analyzing that game at all. Because so much of it is kind of outlined in exactly what you just said. You had multiple plays, specifically Harden himself, just not boxing out. Which, granted, he's not like, I mean, he's not the Brook Lopez of boxing out. So, not a stunner, but just plays where he's just standing there and guys come from behind him and grab loose balls. Jimmy Butler had one where he, you know, he took the shot and then like tracked down his own rebound and then hit a three on that possession that essentially ended the game. There was just so little effort. I mean, Tim Legler had a pretty good breakdown last night on SportsCenter after the game was over, or after the games were over, and was pointing out one where Harden threw the ball away, and you know, he just basically let Bam Adebayo walk into a dunk when Harden, I don't know if he could have gone step for step with him. Bam's strides are longer, Bam's younger, whatever, but like, it's a game seven, you're down 14, 16, whatever it was, at a key pivotal stage in the game where your team needs you to do something, anything, more than take two shots in the second half. Like, that's why they brought you there. So his effort was just kind of ghastly, and it's getting really difficult to see how he ever kind of sheds this playoff label.
Because I mean, yeah,
ever.
We've gotta,
I mean, like, even if he wins it at this point, we're looking now at a stage where he's not going to be the lead guy to take a team to a title. He's been in a role now, and really two roles now, where you could look at him as like the secondary guy, or I think it might be going a little bit far to say like the tertiary guy, but like Brooklyn was set up for it to potentially be that, or at least like a 2A. You know, I think everybody would look at Durant as the best guy on that team. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know what to make of it other than it's a horrible look for him, even if he's not healthy, which I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that maybe he's not with regards to the hamstring and everything else. But are you doing everything you possibly can within that? Because we've seen him show burst. We've seen him have moments, even in this series, where he's a difference maker. And then we've just seen moments where yesterday was just disgusting from an effort standpoint. And it was not just him. I mean, there are other guys, too, that really did not give much. But it's just it sucks to see Embiid not only play through the stuff he's playing through. And granted, he didn't play well yesterday, but he's out there and, you know, getting hit in the face in the middle of this series when he's already got an orbital fracture. I complain a lot about the mic'd up sessions and stuff during the games when they mic up a player or a coach because they divulge so little. But I thought yesterday was one of the most telling ones I'd ever seen. I think there was one where Kerr had one a couple years ago where I was like, I can't believe they're showing this on television. But there was a moment yesterday where Doc was just imploring the Sixers basically to care. And I was like, wow. And I'm not someone that has been saying, you know, Doc should lose his job. I'm still not saying that. But the lack of response there, whether in the huddle or just once they went back on the court, or the fact that you have to say that in the first place when you're one game away, one win away from forcing a game seven. And, you know, just kind of stunning to watch and disappointing to watch for a team where, like, Embiid was relatively healthy this year. Embiid was, you know, 1A, 1B with Jokic. Maybe, you know, maybe Giannis is 1C. I think you had him second, you were saying. So, but MVP-level season from your guy who Absolutely. Has never been consistently healthy. You don't get many years like this, and you're probably not going to get that many more years like this out of Embiid. So it felt really, it was disgusting to watch. Like, I keep using that word, but it was wasted. And, I don't know. I've probably gone on too long about it, but it was just kind of jarring to watch it play out. By the way, I hated seeing Danny Green get hurt. Not just mm-hmm. hurt, but like that looked like a particularly bad injury. And we normally don't see that with guys that age and like with role players. We saw the one, obviously the Kobe's Achilles was devastating for all sorts of reasons, but that one was brutal just because it was like his own teammate falling on him. I saw plenty of people, you know, I don't even know if they were joking, saying like Embiid is always flopping and Embiid is always falling. Now he's done it. He's fallen on his own teammate. I'm not going to get into that, but it sucked to watch that. I know it's maybe not the most important takeaway from the game yesterday, but you know, he's a guy I've enjoyed watching for years and a key role player on key teams. I hated seeing that injury, and I feel like it's kind of gotten swept under the rug under the circumstances. Yeah, Danny, and everything else.
I'll get into Danny in a second. I have a quick trivia question for you. How many times do you think James Harden isolated in game six?
I actually would have no clue because I'm so locked in on that one play now that I can't see anything else in my head. But he did complain. Like, he had a few, and I feel like he did complain later. He didn't complain, but he said, you know, I'm just playing within the offense. The ball didn't find its way back to me. And it's like, you know, you're James Harden. Like, if you want the ball, you're going to have the ball in your hands. But what's the answer?
Three times. He isolated three times in the game, which is a shocking number. In 43 minutes. 43 minutes. There were minutes. A few. 0 points in the second half. 15 fewer than Shake Milton scored in the second half. Going back to my original point, look, Embiid was understandably bad. And when you take away his physicality and render him a jump shooter, he's not efficient. He's not impactful. Defensively, they were going at him from the jump. Like, early in the game, they were not really, the Heat were not petrified of the paint either. I thought Tyrese Maxey's defense was really bad. And just like talking after the game, you know, I just think it's interesting how, I mean, Embiid essentially saying like publicly that this is not the Houston version of James Harden.
Yeah, man.
And he's a playmaker. I've, you know, this is 2 years in a row where he does this after his team gets eliminated. It's like kind of suspect behavior, I'm not going to lie. I know that it's the truth, but like you shouldn't say that if you're Joel Embiid.
Here's the thing with that.
I don't know what it accomplishes.
I mean, like he's in a rare spot where he's such an unquestioned star, the star, the franchise player, the guy that no matter what's happening, you're not letting him go, that it affords you the right to be able to say whatever you want to say. I don't know that that equates to good leadership. You know, as we talk about somebody like Steph, who Steph obviously, of all the things he does well, I think that kind of is understated with him, like how little drama there is generally with what he says. There is a ton of noise out there in the, you know, in the basketball spheres about whose team is this, who's better, Steph or KD. Steph never played that game. Steph bent over backwards seemingly to reduce that.
Steph got on a plane when KD was a free agent and learned that KD was signing in Brooklyn when he was in the air to meet KD, which was like the ultimate selfless act.
Right, and it's interesting too. Obviously Draymond had a big role in KD coming there in the first place. He also had a seemingly big role in KD leaving because of the blow up they had in the middle of that one game.
The Clippers. Yeah.
Right. So it's like Draymond is Draymond. He runs really hot when he's upset. We know that he gets very emotional when he's upset. Steph is so even keel. And Embiid, I mean, he's saying it with a level tone. It's not like he's screaming this stuff at the media. It's that he takes the truth serum and he's telling the truth, which I get it on its face. Him being the unquestioned star of the team, he has the right to say it. It's the truth. But it's also, when you look at the Simmons situation, Simmons handled it very poorly. There's no question. But if you know that people have a tendency to kind of, what's the word I'm looking for here? Flinch and kind of counterpunch because of what you're saying, and then hold out, you know, take passive aggressive jabs at you, it creates an awkward dynamic that guys may not want to be there. Now, I will say this, if you created a situation where Harden doesn't want to be there anymore, you might be doing the right thing, which is different conversation. Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen. And meanwhile, James Harden also said, I'll be here next year, which is like, I've been in situations sometimes where maybe there was a girl I was dating and I really didn't want her to stay any longer than she already had. And that's kind of what I immediately thought of when he was like, I'll be here. It's like, man, but can you just go home? $47 million is a lot of money, which is why he will probably be there. But you have to raise serious, serious questions about what that looks like. And that has to be the end of it. But it's an interesting question, depending on what Daryl Morey promised him or heavily suggested he would give him if he agreed to be traded there. So I have no clue what's going to happen next. It'll be fascinating. Yeah.
So I guess zooming out really quick about Philadelphia, one of the reasons I didn't like them as an actual title contender, even when Joel Embiid was healthy, was they don't have any wing defenders. And so when Danny Green went down early on, 3 minutes into game six, it was like Danny Green's low key a critical player for this team. Not only was he one of the only guys who was making threes, and he did hit a three before he got hurt, but he's at least a wing body you can throw on Hero. He's a wing body you can throw on Jimmy, although it wouldn't even matter.
You have Thibault, but he can't shoot. He's not a consistent enough shooter to be able to do it all. Obviously.
Correct. And they were playing lineups where Thibault was on the floor with Shake Milton. And I'm like, okay, what are we doing? But
right.
you look at Jimmy Butler's series And this man averaged 27.5 points. He made over half of his shots. In the second half of game six, he scored 23 points and was 10 for 19 from the field. Just absolute dominance. And not to take anything away from him, but the Sixers just can't match up with wing scorers. And the most important, one of the most important things, second to a superstar, is like you need two-way wings to win in the NBA playoffs in 2022. Sixers didn't have it. Didn't have any of them, really. Right. So that's number one why I was like, it's kind of like there's no point in crapping on James Harden and saying, hey, we don't have any PJ Tucker guys who are like tough like PJ Tucker. I just don't understand what that accomplishes when you kind of know that, yeah, we can just talk about this right now about the player option situation. Like, to lay it out, James Harden has a $47.3 million player option for next season, and he is going to opt in. I would be shocked if he opted out. It makes no sense for him to opt out, and I think that the Sixers would probably prefer that as well, even though it doesn't look great right now. But you could, you can tinker around the margins as best you can if you're Daryl Morey this offseason. You know you have James. Maybe James was hurt after they got him, or he tweaked his hamstring at some point. I don't know. I kind of doubt that that's the case, just because we saw flashes of him being really good in a Sixers uniform. So I you know, I don't want to say that the hamstring was the reason why he struggled at times in the postseason, but you could add more three-point shooting. You can find some of those wings. Maybe, I don't know what happens with Tobias Harris, who could have upped his trade value a little bit, even though his contract is really, really, really bad. So I don't really know even know what point I'm trying to make beyond, like, I you didn't really have a great chance regardless, even though some people will say that the Sixers were legitimate title contenders and you could make that argument. I just never even believed it for those reasons. So, and Jimmy Butler kind of exposed that. So, I like, do you agree, first of all, do you just agree that Harden's going to opt in, like, as emphatically as I believe it?
I mean, the only situation in which you'd be thinking that he doesn't or does not want to, again, and keep in mind, yesterday he said, I'll be here. So, to me, that alone signals that that's the most likely option. We've rarely seen people turn down that much money for a single year unless there's more promised. We're not looking at a situation in which he's going to be promised more than that, I don't think, unless, and I guess you could consider this if you're the Sixers, but I don't know why you'd want to. If you're willing to let him say, if you're willing to say, okay, 47 is a huge cap number, let's give you 90 over three, which if Harden is healthy and can get back to what he looked like before the last few months. But I like, are you really willing to risk that after what you just watched yesterday and what we've seen throughout his playoff career? Like, is that the running mate? Is someone with that playoff track record the running mate you want for Joel Embiid for the rest of, I mean, how old is Joel Embiid? Like, close to the rest of his prime? I don't think you do. And, you know, and that's something where, like, again, Morey is the executive here. And so maybe to some extent, you have stronger feelings about James Harden and what you think he can do and what you're convinced he can do. But unless something like that is laid out to him, where you're going to shorten his money for next year, but pay him more money. I mean, Harden may feel like this is it for me. I know I can't play way, way better than this. And because of that, I don't even really want to play out next season's deal because I'll earn way, way, way less than that next year. And then because of that, the year after that and the year after that. So you would find it more reasonable to sign something that is long-term but less money per year. By the way, before we move on to the next thing, Harden turned down a huge extension from the Nets last year, which, you know, maybe he didn't see this decline coming. Maybe he didn't see himself being injured. He certainly probably didn't see the stuff with Kyrie happening and then, you know, Durant being out. But as we talk about someone like Dennis Schroeder, who turned down a lot of money, like the Harden one is not looking great right now either. 47 is a lot of money to have for 1 year, but I don't know realistically, who's going to want to pay him beyond this year and how much money anyone's going to want to pay him, the Sixers or otherwise. So I think he's back next year. I don't really see a way around that unless the Sixers, you know, obviously they don't have a choice as to whether he opts in, but does that, and then maybe you're trying to trade him away for something, but what are you getting back? Like, you'd have to give away something to be able to do it. And I don't even know what that looks like.
I mean, honestly, it's like you, the Knicks. It's like, it's like, do you seriously consider, if you were Morey, would you seriously consider just taking Maxey, pairing him with Harris, and just shopping that for, like, I don't even know who the superstar on the max contract is who's out there, where that makes sense. Maybe it's Beal. I honestly don't know. Is that like an option here? I don't know what they do, because you need shooting to have Harden on your team playing 40 plus minutes in a playoff series. You need shooting, a lot of it, and you need a lot of versatile defenders. Like, that's just absolutely critical. And those are expensive players, so that's why paying him all this money is really detrimental to them actually being a title contender anytime soon. I don't know what it is that they do here. It's pretty rough. Can we you mentioned Doc Rivers a few minutes ago. Do you think Doc stays? Do you think they... Can I give you my theory? I think I've said this before on the show. I'm not positive.
Sure, go ahead.
But I think Doc is going to be the head coach of the Utah Jazz next year, and I think that Mike D'Antoni is going to be the head coach of the Philadelphia 76ers.
Who takes the Lakers job?
Who cares? Rondo.
Wow. Utah, though. Wow. Ooh, boy.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the reason I have that is, like, established coach, reputed player-friendly coach, trying to keep Donovan Mitchell happy. I don't think they're going to trade Donovan Mitchell. And Danny Ainge is the guy who's going to be making the decision. And they obviously have a successful relationship, partnership that lasted a very long time in Boston. So that's the connection I see there. I don't know if Philly's going to let him go, though, to be honest. Like, I don't think Doc Rivers was the problem here at all. So just, you know, it would just be fun, honestly, if D'Antoni, if you're trying to get the most out of Harden, make Mike D'Antoni the head coach and just...
But are you going
to
do that for... I mean, like, that part of it, that's the key. I mean, that is... You're totally right that there was more wrong with them than just Harden. There was certainly more wrong with them than just Doc. Embiid was not himself, you know, by the end of the series after he took the whack to the face. So there were a lot of things going on. They were out of wing defenders, certainly after Danny Green was out. But the centerpiece here is, like, how heavily are you believing in James Harden? For instance, if you're just letting him do the one-year opt-in and you have no intent on bringing him back, which, by the way, if you do the one-year opt-in at that point, even if Morey promised you or heavily vowed to you, suggested to you that we're going to keep you for the long haul if you agree to be traded here, I feel like all that is out the window and out the door if Harden then opts into this last year. My hunch would be that Morey told him that with the understanding that he will tear up this last year and sign something longer for the long haul. If he's opting into the last year, he's not doing that. But if it's for 1 year, can you really go get D'Antoni? Do you really want to do that to try to... Do you want to make Harden the focal point of why you're hiring a particular coach? And granted, D'Antoni's a good coach, so it's not me trying to take that away from him. He can be good on his own minus Harden, but man, I don't know about that one. In particular, I don't know about that. I mean, Maxey is a great young player, but if Harden isn't going to be a part of your long-term future and you're entering your long-term years with Embiid, I don't know about that. Oh, not to mention, too, and I think the other thing that people gloss over with Doc, I think he's got 3 years and like $24 million left on his deal, which that's actually pretty considerable money for most teams. I'm thinking about even the Lakers, who like have started pointing to finances a lot more than we're used to seeing big markets teams do. But when you're talking about that much money for Doc, if he doesn't have somewhere else that he's lined up to go, that's a lot of extra money to eat and a lot of extra years to eat. He's only been there 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's likely that he leaves unless he wants to, because he sees the writing on the wall and he sees a situation where it's like the fans are really souring on him very quickly if they have not already soured altogether. I don't think the Sixers are going to have him walk, but I could be completely wrong, unless Morey really sees potential in Harden still and wants to go get Mike D'Antoni. I don't know.
And we should also say, before we move on, that the Sixers once employed Jimmy Butler and could, in another universe, still employ Jimmy Butler. And they instead decided to sign Al Horford and get Josh Richardson. So that was just that's obviously Jimmy screamed Tobias Harris over me.
Yeah, that was a lot. That was almost, I won't say unnecessary. He knew the cameras were there too, I'm sure. I'll say this to anybody that's listening that doesn't already have the context. Yaron Weitzman was a really, really good reporter and wrote, literally.
He's okay. He's all right.
Stop it. He's a good dude. He literally wrote the definitive book on this team as they built this team out with Embiid and Simmons and Fultz and Brett Brown, obviously Sam Hinkie. So he's got a thread on Twitter, if you don't follow him already, on that sequence, but also just the Sixers in general and what happened and what unraveled with Butler. Tobias Harris had very, very little to do with this. I know Butler painted it as him or me in terms of that comment that he made on camera, but that
you could have said Simmons before you said Tobias Harris.
What's that?
You could have said Simmons in terms of the him or me.
Exactly, and that's essentially kind of what Yaron was pointing out in his thread and what comes across in his book. If you haven't read it, you should. It's weird because obviously my book about the 90s Knicks was about a team that didn't win. Yaron wrote his midstream as far as the Sixers. This was written, at this point, a couple years ago. But I think it's interesting to look at how the interpersonal dynamics affect things. And Butler is kind of a very strong personality. But the bigger thing is that he was older. And, he there were questions about his injury history, too. So I don't know. But the Tobias, I felt like that was an unfair shot at Tobias. Like, he's not worth the max deal, certainly. But I feel like there are going to be people that just look at how people ride with whoever's playing well in that moment. It's the reason that, like we said, Embiid can kind of, I won't say get away with saying what he said about Harden and before that about Simmons. He's the best player in the room. But people question it less. And I feel like people will not question what Butler's saying. They'll just take it as gospel. And Tobias Harris was not the reason or had really very little to do with why Jimmy Butler was going somewhere else. It was more about Brett Brown and his questions about Butler, and it was about Ben Simmons and maybe whether he wanted him there, and they were kind of betting more heavily on Ben Simmons.
I loved when Brett Brown called Jimmy Butler James Butler at the post-game press conference in 2019, yep. I think it was. And
yep.
James Butler. And Jimmy Butler was like, "My name is Jimmy." That was just so awkward, and there's only one Jimmy Butler. Yaron's book is called Tanking to the Top, by the way. Everyone should go buy it. It's amazing.
Thank you for plugging it. Yeah.
Okay, do you have anything else to say about this series or these teams? I know we didn't really talk about Miami, but there's plenty of time to talk about them in the future. They are going to the conference finals, and they're very good.
That's all I was going to say, is that I on some level, I hate how much of this will become, just kind of the post-mortem. Same thing sort of with Utah when Dallas was moving on. But I think the difference is, something where the Heat outworked the Sixers. Tucker and Max Strus had more offensive rebounds than the whole Sixers team yesterday. These are guys that are 6'5 and 6'6, and they out-rebounded the whole team, from an offensive rebounding standpoint. So they worked hard, which is what they do, which is what they're known for. I thought Oladipo stepping up was kind of a revelation in this series, them doing what they did without Lowry, which also probably speaks to how not 100% Lowry has been, was a revelation in this series. I don't know what it means for the next series, because some of these things are not going to get you past the other two teams that are still left in the dance in the East. So it was really a good show of resolve from them, certainly to come back and kind of respond to being punched in the mouth after being up 2-0. But I don't know what to make of them yet. I think they've still got major questions from a half-court offense standpoint. But anyway, like you said, we'll have more opportunities to talk about them.
Let's move on to Mavs-Suns. This series is fascinating.
Yes.
The Dallas Mavericks blew out the Phoenix Suns 113-86 last night. And Luka Doncic was incredible. He is the only reason why I picked Mavs in seven. And it was basically, it's following kind of the track that I saw, which is just, if you get to a game seven, I'm not betting against that guy because he can do, he can just dominate. I don't care what the defense is. I don't care what the scheme is, who's on the other side. He's just an absolutely incredible offensive player, and he showed it last night with his vision, with his passing. He had the three ball going a little bit. Chris Paul finished with 13 points, five turnovers, five fouls. Another weird game from CP. Chris, how nervous are you, my friend, my ardent Suns believer friend? How nervous are you in this team right now, getting into Game 7?
I mean, to reiterate, you said you had the Mavs in 7, which I remember. I had the Suns in 7. Never thought it would be easy necessarily for them. I'm worried and I'm not. The main worry here is just that the Suns have played like crap. And that's, we have to give full credit to Dallas for having, brought that about. Chris Paul has had, three weird games in a row. Or I guess not in a row, but just he's had three games in the series that have just been really off by his standards. I've made the joke before that, ever since him turning exactly 37 years old, like he hasn't been the same dude. That he had a very firm expiration date on his game, basically. And it's like not as funny anymore to say that just because it's like, come on, man. Like, we need you. Not we, but the Suns obviously need him. The Mavs basically defending Devin Booker a different way seemed to throw them off in the last game as far as really blitzing him and not allowing him to try to attack around screens and really hunt certain people out of screens.
Booker had eight turnovers. I know. That should be said. Yeah.
It's huge. Between that and the fact that, that comes as they're trying to, really as Chris Paul is not looking himself, trying to put more in Devin Booker's hands. They're really not playing campaign in this series at all, much at all. So he's been missing in action. And so by definition, that's going to put more on Devin Booker's shoulders. But they defended him a different way that really worked in this last game. So, that's the bad is that, like, y'all going to wake up? Chris Paul? Are you still Chris Paul? Is it Cliff Paul? So that's the question. The thing you feel good about, the only thing you feel good about among, all these things, is that the series has seemed to really, really take on a different cadence and tone depending on where the games are being played. So for a game seven,
home team hasn't lost yet. Exactly.
And I mean, to be real with you, the games really haven't been that close. At least, there've been situations where the game was close for three quarters and then a team pulls away, but the games have not been all that competitive depending on where the game is being played. So you feel good from that standpoint, but that's not something that you really want to rest your laurels on. Like, it really does feel like there's going to need to be something schematically that you're trying to do here. If you're Phoenix, like I said, Dallas kind of retorted in game six after, watching Booker just hunt guys in game five, hunt Luka in game five a lot of times. They had a different pick and roll coverage for game six. And so I'm not sure what Phoenix responds with. What I would love to see on some level, which is not really schematic as much as it is just like, let's do something different. You and I have talked a lot about Devin Booker and how aggressive he is in first quarters and how much he scores in first quarters. Chris Paul did nothing in the last game, in game one. I don't even know that he took a shot. I think the only thing he had on his box score other than minutes played was a turnover in game one. Or I'm sorry, in game six in the first quarter, I think. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go back and look specifically. We're used to seeing him kind of save the best for last. Part of me would like to see him kind of get going. I mean, and this is a total departure from what he normally does, but part of me would like to see him get going in the early stages of the game just so that you're not getting a flat performance from him. Set the tone early. You can't knock a team out with Chris Paul going off in the first quarter, but I'd like to see him be more aggressive. He's just been really off. He's throwing passes that are kind of out. There was a play in the last game or the game before that where he had a really clear left-handed layup that he just threw a pass after he got all the way to the basket. It was weird. He's thrown passes from half court out to the corner, and Spencer Dinwiddie, of all people, is like stepping in front of him. It's just weird. Weird vibes. You would hope that being at home really breaks that. But like I said, I'm not comfortable resting on that. So, I mean, game sevens are always weird anyway, or have the potential to be. So I don't feel great about it. I mean, I would pick them for game seven, but I certainly don't feel good about it. I certainly don't feel good anytime that Chris Paul looks like he's out of a rhythm for this long of a stretch, because we almost never see it. I can't remember the last time we've really seen it.
Yeah. CP also fell late in the game on his hand. I don't know what the latest is on that. Something maybe to keep an eye on going forward. And Frank Ntilikina's defense on him has been like excellent for 10 minutes a game in this series. I kind of feel like they're hunting Luka too much. Like, when you do, it's just like, it's not who they are. And this is kind of the give and take with the idea of hunting a weak individual defender in the postseason. Like, Phoenix during the regular season had a great offense because they just ran their stuff and they out-executed you, and stack pick and roll, side pick and rolls, the DHOs with Ayton, and guys would, you know, they'd make angle cuts, baseline cuts, they could space the floor, and they just always kept moving the ball and just kind of churning through their offense, going from action to action to action until you made a mistake. And they're not really doing that, or they didn't really do that much in game six. And it's like, I know they ran a ton of pick and roll with CP and Ayton, and you have to credit Dallas's defense there. I mean, they threw everything, every type of coverage you can really have at that pick and roll. And I thought the weak side help was like excellent all game. They would switch and they would front. Whoever was on CP would switch, front Ayton, and then there would be help on the backside. Sometimes they messed it up and Ayton scored over the top. But I thought that like, that strategy was working really well for Dallas. But like, I guess my point is just when you look at kind of the offensive rating for Phoenix, which has been really bad in these losses, it's like, maybe you should just go back to what got you here. Credit Dallas's defense for what they're doing and how hard they're playing. And, you know, being versatile and big and being able to switch and all that is really, it's mucking up a lot of what Phoenix does, but just like stop hunting Luka. I know it sounds really silly. Like, do it in spots. You don't need to do it on every single play. You're bringing Jay Crowder into the action. That's really not like great for you. He's Jay Crowder at the end of the day. So that's just an observation that I have after watching game six.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's the truth. And too much of anything can be a bad thing. When you start naturally going outside of, it's almost like a game of horse or something where you're like, you start calling particular shots or saying that you're going to do this as opposed to just doing it, just playing the game. And especially when Jason Kidd, to his credit, which by the way, a lot of people throughout the season, before the season, thought that Jason Kidd would be a bad fit for Dallas. It's just the first year. We have to see more. They've done really well. This is not a team that I think of as being that strong defensively. They don't have a whole lot of individual defenders. Reggie Bullock and obviously Dorian Finney-Smith we know about. But other guys have kind of, they're more than the sum of their parts, I think. Jason Kidd has had a really good game plan for them. He's had really good rebuttals in this series, including the one that I mentioned before about game six. So when Dallas and Jason Kidd are making it more difficult intentionally for you to be able to hunt people, you might actually get to them, but still may not have a great advantage there. And that, you know, when you think about how well this offense plays when the ball's just popping and guys are open. I mean, we can talk about that too when we talk about the series. I was counting it up before the podcast started. We're talking about a 93-point difference in this series so far through six games in terms of the how much they've been outscored by from three and the free throw difference, which we know Phoenix is a team that does not get to the line that much because of the types of shots they're getting from mid-range often. But they, you know, they're getting killed from the three-point line. That's the big, big difference, certainly on the road for Phoenix. You're hoping that that doesn't get as out of whack in a game seven at home, but you can't really afford to have possessions where you're trying so hard to make something work when you might be able to get a better shot just running your normal offense. No question.
Yeah, so I really don't have anything else to say about this series. This, I mean, the three-point line disparity is humongous, as you pointed out, and should have been like the lead of this conversation. When Dallas shoots a lot of threes and makes a lot of threes, they're really hard to beat. And Reggie Bullock was the guy last night. Dorian Finney-Smith was the guy in game game five, was it? Yeah, I don't even remember. I'm not good at remembering individual games in a series. It's not my skill. But he had a big game earlier in the series. And so if you're able to hit threes on the road in Phoenix and Luka's diming people up, then I feel pretty good about the Mavs. That said, I'm waiting for CP to look like CP, to get to that right elbow and hit those shots over Maxi Kleber. You know what I mean? Like, I'm waiting to see that. Why? Like, why didn't we see it in games? It's weird that that has gone away. And I wonder if he's not dealing with something physically. Frankly, like, that's really the only explanation that I have for how poorly he's played, and his decision making has been uncharacteristically atrocious at times. So game seven is going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait to watch that one. You want to move on real quick? I know it's we're recording this on a Friday afternoon. There's two game sixes tonight. The Boston Celtics are playing the Milwaukee Bucks. The result of that will either render me into a puddle or an angel flying, fluttering over my apartment building. We'll see. The Memphis Grizzlies are playing the Golden State Warriors after that. Which one do you want to start with? We're just going to real quickly give a little overview, quick little, super quick preview, but which series do you want to talk about first?
I don't feel like I have a ton of like analysis for the Grizzlies Warriors series. So why don't we do that one first?
And end I don't with either. The one that
is, you know, why don't we start with that one? Since it's just kind of like, I'm interested to see what happens. I think Memphis can certainly hold their own in a game six. I don't think we'll see a repeat of game five in game six in San Francisco. But why don't we talk about that one first? Because I think it's less compelling than the one between Boston and Milwaukee.
I mean, so game five of that series, the Grizzlies won 134-95.
Yep.
It was like one of the most shocking playoff like games I've seen in, I don't even know how long. I was just like, I put the notebook away. I was like, what am I supposed to make of this? Is this a fluke? Desmond Bane finally looked like his back didn't hurt, which should make the Warriors a little nervous. But like, the Warriors did not seem nervous at all. There's footage of Draymond Green whipping his towel around over his head as Whoop That Trick's playing in FedEx Forum. Steph Curry has not had really a Steph Curry game in a minute now. Klay Thompson's shot selection has been really up and down in this entire series. And, you know, credit to Taylor Jenkins for, you know, the decision to put Steven Adams back in. And, like, you would think that on paper, just you could attack Steven Adams in a pick and roll with Draymond, put Draymond at the five, bring Adams into a pick and roll with Steph, and it would just be barbecue chicken. It is not. Steven Adams is moving his feet. Steven Adams is playing really well in space. And, you know, he's running Steph off the three-point line. And when he does that, Jaren Jackson Jr. is coming over, to trap the box. And then this team is so disciplined defensively, the Grizzlies, like they can run out and run guys off the 3-point line and help the helper. And they're just really good, really, really good defensive team, especially it's messed up to say this, especially when John Morant is not on the floor and you can't just pick on somebody.
It's not messed up to say it though. And I mean, like that was the thing is, you know, Matt, shout out to Matt Wong, was asking me earlier in the week, did I want to write something about, you know, after the Ja injury, did I want to write something about how the Grizzlies look without Ja Morant? I'd already written something in late April when they were, you know, that extended period where they didn't have him. And, you know, at the time, I think they were 19-2 or 20-2. They finished the season 20-5. That doesn't happen through a fluke. It doesn't. I mean, there's a couple things you could, you know, lend to kind of explain it. I think Taylor Jenkins did a wonderful job with this team. I think that this was a team that, you know, their offense looked a lot different and maybe you're not as prepared for them. It's with a point guard that doesn't turn the ball over at all, really. And it has a great, one of the best assist to turnover ratios we've ever seen.
I love Tyus Jones. He's like one of my favorite
players.
His
summer is going to be really interesting. We talk a lot about Jalen Brunson. His summer is going to be interesting. I think because he's not under contract, I don't think.
He's restricted. That is correct.
Okay, so he's restricted, but someone should throw a bag at him. A relative bag at him. I mean, he's, you know, I don't think he's a franchise player or anything, but he's really, really good, and that's not a skill that everybody has. Certainly, you know, with the tempo that they play at to kind of still moderate that. But, I mean, the key thing here that is not up for debate is that they're way better defensively. They force more turnovers. They're not as easy to kind of take advantage of. Playoff hunting is a big thing in all these series. We've even talked about it in the Celtics series as it relates to someone like Jaylen Brown, which is crazy to say that, but like you have to be an average defender and most times a really good defender not to get hunted ever. Ja's not at that level, and it's part of the reason that the team did so well when he was out. It's not that Ja's not good, it's that he's not good defensively, and this is a team that is really good defensively without him. So, I mean, that's the big key here, I think, for this game. You know, like I said, I don't have many notes, but I think the Grizzlies have to be just on top of everything. They cannot turn the ball over. They have to not foul, which I'm looking directly at you, Jaren Jackson Jr. You have to play really, really stout, solid defense, which they have done now for two games in a row. Even the one that they lost by three, holding the Warriors to 101 points, like that's exactly what you have to do, particularly when you're playing them in San Francisco. It's the only way I think they realistically have a shot, because I think Golden State will, not to say they weren't taking that game seriously, because Golden State can lose a game too. Memphis shot really, really well, all sorts of other things. It was at Memphis. They were charged up. I think they want to prove a point that they can win without Ja. It's harder to do on the road. It's harder to do when you would be tying the series and then you're playing with fire at that point if you're Golden State. So they have to do everything right, but that starts with their defense here in game six.
Yeah, Steven Adams is plus 45 in 49 minutes in the last two games. The Grizzlies are minus 9 when he sits. So I keep harping on his impact. But I did this interview with Stan Van Gundy that's up on the site right now, and we talked about Bucks Celtics, which we're about to get into. But at the top of that interview, he said that Bucks Celtics was his favorite playoff series that he's seen in years, because the competitive fire that was from possession to possession is something that you just don't usually see. And then unprompted, he said that, you know, there are other teams in the playoffs that, like, the Celtics and the Bucks are not taking a play off. Other teams in the playoffs, he's noticed, are taking nights off. And he didn't say the Golden State Warriors, but our interview was, like, right after, a day after that. And he did bring up the fact that they got blown out multiple times throughout the interview. So that was, like, you know, you don't want to say, like, they took the night off and they don't care. It's the playoffs. These guys have a championship pedigree, et cetera. But, like, I mean, there's really no other way to explain it. Like, it was just a really bizarre game. Okay, so Bucks Celtics, I'm going to be honest with you. It took me a while, personally, not professionally, to recover after watching that game. I thought that the Celtics clearly blew a golden opportunity to go up 3-2 going to Milwaukee tonight. It was really interesting. The one strategic thing that I want to point out that is fascinating that people should be looking for tonight is the Boston Celtics in game four had a lot of success going small with Derek White, Marcus Smart, Jalen, Jason, and Al Horford at the five. A lot of success with that lineup. Hadn't really used it in the postseason up until that game. Ime went back to it in game five, and Bud adjusted by going a little bit bigger, playing Bobby Portis, and the rest is kind of history. Bobby Portis had seven offensive rebounds against that small lineup.
Yep.
In the fourth quarter, or I should say in the game, he had seven offensive rebounds. The Celtics had five offensive rebounds in the entire game, and the Bucks had 17 in the game, I want to say. Yes, I think that is accurate. The one thing that, and this is another thing Stan and I talked about, just offensive rebounding and what do you do to, I mean, is it all just, okay, I mean, Giannis had a few that were just like, okay, well, Drew's just going to, there's going to be a switch. Horford's going to switch out, or Grant's going to switch out onto Drew. Drew's going to throw up some slop. No chance it's going in, and Giannis is just, he rolled yep. to the basket and just grabbed it and dunked it. And that happened like yep. three times in the game. So what's interesting to me going forward for tonight is, do you go back to that small lineup? Do you abandon it? Are you going to overcompensate for the offensive rebounding? You still could have won the game if Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown didn't collide with one another on Giannis's missed free throw.
Yeah.
And the Bucks went 6-for-6 from behind the three-point line in the fourth quarter also, which needs to be mentioned. It wasn't 100% because of...
Did they really? Good yeah. Lord.
So they were hitting shots, and it's a shot.
I know they were
league.
Making shots, but I didn't realize they made all six. Wow.
Yeah, so that was also a humongous factor in them coming back and winning. But do you go small? Do you stay small? Do you go bigger? If Rob Williams plays, that obviously changes things. I have a bad feeling about him playing. Has a bone bruise. That's why he's missed the last two games. Bone bruise in his knee.
Same injury that John Morant has, by the way. So it shows you the nature of bone bruises, and one, probably how painful they are, but two, how they're definitely not one size fits all as far as how they impact people and the threshold of what guys try to play through. Oh, and it also probably is a lot different for a point guard who's as shifty as Ja is, mm-hmm. who's already being hunted the way he was defensively.
So what is sustainable in this series? Is anything sustainable, Chris? Like, what are you thinking right now? These teams have just been like win, loss, win, loss, win, loss.
It's haymakers.
It's incredible. It's a really fun series. Giannis had an absolutely unbelievable game five. What are you thinking going into game six? Are Celtics going to win this one on the road and force a game seven, or do you think the Bucks kind of punch them in the mouth again?
It's going to be the toughest game, I think, that Boston's had, you know, at this iteration of this team. Just the atmosphere in Milwaukee. I think it was fair to maybe think this anyway, but certainly watching how stuff just played out in the Miami series, and watching how Phoenix is struggling, watching Golden State not put away a Memphis team that is shorthanded at the head of the snake, it's really fair to think that whoever wins this series becomes the favorite, at least for now, remaining in the playoffs. Certainly if Milwaukee wins in six, but even if Boston comes back to win the last two, they will have survived a gauntlet, like a physical gauntlet. You know, if they win this series, if they come from behind to win this series, if they go into Milwaukee tonight and win this game, they easily could have won the last game. So I think the point you raised a few minutes ago is really, really important just to watch, to see, does Boston seek to overcorrect something that barely cost them the game? They easily could have won the game despite all the stuff you just talked about, if not for a Bobby Portis rebound. You kind of took all the words out of my mouth with regards to kind of you had asked me in our outline, like, pick out one thing about each series that kind of, you know, that you see as being key. I circled offensive rebounding and put exclamation points on either side of the phrase. Because from games one and two, game two, the Bucks had a 13.2% offensive rebound rate, meaning that they grabbed 13% of their own misses in game two. Game three, it was 26.5. And that was a game in which they had six offensive rebounds in the third quarter where they just blasted the Celtics. Game four was 27.7% of their own misses they grabbed. Game five was 35.5 for Milwaukee. It's really hard to win that way when you're playing against a Giannis Antetokounmpo-led team, because you're already getting so many looks deep in the paint, and then you add that to it where you're just getting to put back those misses. And granted, you are so focused on Drew and on Giannis, particularly on Giannis, it's understandable how a lot of those rebounds are going to slip. It's also understandable if you're trying to use smaller guys to do it, to try to stop those guys defensively. But it can't happen. And, I mean, you saw literally one play, just how much it swings everything or can swing everything. So I don't know whether they'll seek to overcorrect that. I think it might be a mistake to go too far in that direction, to play much bigger, to play Rob Williams if his mobility isn't good. You'd almost be better holding him out, I think, hoping that you can get to a game seven, which they almost did that anyway, or at least forced it, you know, went up 3-2, you know, which would have nullified the need for him as much in this game. So I don't know. I hope they don't overcorrect too much, because they could have won that game. They should have won that game. But this game is gonna be, I mean, like, this series to me, we're going into a game seven with Mavs, Suns 2, but maybe because those games haven't been as close, the Celtics Bucks series is the best one I've seen in a while. I know that the Bucks Nets series last year was plenty entertaining, but you were dealing with some pretty key injuries in that series. I mean, I guess you have Middleton out too. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's one of the more entertaining series I've watched in a while. I get why some people have not loved every aspect of it, from the physicality, the officiating, what have you, but it's just two teams that are very, very capable of winning a title, just punching the crap out of each other, and you're getting really great end-of-game sequences. That last game was incredible, just like the first game was, just like, you know. So I'm enjoying it. I'm really looking forward to seeing whether Boston's up to the task here on the road.
I'm getting severe anxiety just now talking to you about this, so I don't have anything more to say. I wanted game six to just be played last night to get it over with, honestly. It's just like hanging over my life right now in detrimental ways. Yeah, I'm kind of nervous, I'm not going to lie. I thought Celtics were the better team coming into the series. I was pretty confident in their ability to just force Drew Holiday into bad shots. He hit some tough ones in the fourth quarter, for sure. Giannis hit a three. Giannis also hit a three in the third near the end, I want to say, that like silenced one of like Jaylen Brown's one-man fireworks display.
Man,
runs.
Jaylen Brown had that stretch where he was just incredible. I was watching the game at a bar with Jay Adande, and I was just like, the dude was just incredible for like a 3-4 minute stretch. It was insane.
So, yeah, I don't really have
it's any- crazy that they didn't get that game. Like, it that game felt like, I don't know. I said at one point that the Heat Sixers game at one point yesterday felt like, you've seen that meme before with the video games where it's like your opponent has left the match, where they just unplug their controller or they turn off the game. There were moments in which it started to feel that way in the Bucks Celtics game in game five. But like you said, Giannis kind of had an answer in one of those moments, and it was just like just enough of a trickle to keep the faucet on for them. It's not to just kind of drive a knife through you, but it's kind of shocking that they didn't get that game. But it, you know, championship, I feel like a lot of championship teams, they have a moment where their back's against the wall. This would be that moment for Boston, you know, on the road, a game where, you know, you should have had it. You could have had it. You should have had it. You know, the Robert Williams injury matters. They haven't been great with him on the court this series anyway. So it'll just be interesting to watch. How do these guys respond? How does Ime Udoka, a first-year head coach, respond, as far as does he try to make some adjustments, but does he go too far in doing that? As far mm-hmm. as taking something off the table that might be helpful for them, but because it got you beaten one aspect, that you just do away with it. I think that's the big question here, like you said, because offensive rebounding has hurt them. But also they found some effectiveness on the other end by going a little bit smaller.
It's just ironic because they got Brook Lopez off the Brook Lopez didn't play a minute or a second right. in the fourth quarter. And I was like, that's one of the keys to this series. So it can open up when you go small, open up driving lanes for Tatum, who had a lot of success in game four, just wasn't hitting makeable shots in game five.
Like what, and that's like what's the likelihood of Brook Lopez being off the court for a whole fourth quarter? And you said the Bucks went 6 for 6 from three. So Brook mm-hmm. had no part in that. That's one of those things where that's why I'm saying, like, you don't want to overcorrect, because how much of that is it's a great team. They're defending champs. But how much of that is repeatable without no Chris Middleton and no Brook Lopez, and you go 6 for 6 in the fourth, which involves Giannis shooting threes too, where Giannis has been brutal from outside. So that's why, like, if you don't think that's something that can easily be repeated, you don't want to run away from that as fast as you can. Like, I hope Ime Udoka doesn't just kind of scrap that entirely as far as going small, because there's some success there for them to be had.
Absolutely. We're going to close on one quick mailbag question, because okay. I promised David in our last episode that I would read it on this episode. David writes, of the players that did not make the playoffs or have been eliminated, who are you missing most? I really love watching Nikola Jokic. Playoff Kawhi is also breathtaking. Any players you wish you could be watching right now? Thanks as always. You all are the absolute best. Thank you, David. Very fun email. Chris, does anyone who kind of stands out to you? I have a couple quick names I want to drop here, but who are you thinking about?
I feel like my answers are not going to be that unique or novel. It's very weird to not be seeing LeBron this time of year in the playoffs at all.
He did not come into my brain at all. That's a great answer. I don't know why. I just completely forgot about him.
I think because we're thinking about guys that are fun. Like, I don't know that LeBron's like fun to watch. He's just a great dominant player that, you know, normally owns the stage. But, you know, certainly to certain fan bases, he's really not fun. Like, if you're Toronto or Atlanta or something like that, he's probably not at the top of your list. But the other one that I think I have on my list, and the reason it's like not a novel idea, was in the question. I'm watching the Celtics and I'm watching certainly the Bucks and thinking about the Sixers, and I'm just like, man, Kawhi, just how he kind of laid waste to a couple of those teams. Certainly the Sixers and the Bucks. It sucks not getting to see him. Obviously, he got knocked out of last year's playoffs as well. Or not knocked out, but, you know, he was injured during a key stage of the playoffs last year. He's just so dominant, and he's the kind of player that in a playoff series can just will you to victories because he's that good. I mean, we saw him do that against the Bucks. You and I were talking on the last podcast about how the last time we really saw Giannis up against a defense this good, this deep, was probably that Toronto team. Right. And so, I mean, Kawhi is maybe he was actually the first guy that came to mind. And then I was like, oh yeah, LeBron used to do this every year, go to the playoffs and make it this far in the playoffs every year. So it's weird not seeing him. I don't know that I'm missing it as much because we have gotten to see it every year. But Kawhi is a guy that just, you know, who has not had so many playoff opportunities to just shine as like a singular guy. And so would like to see more opportunities of that. And also just the sort of injury he's dealing with and the sorts of injuries he's had over the last few years. You don't know how many more opportunities you'll get to see that. He's had a very short prime, if you could really call it that, just as far as the number of like singular playoff moments he's had. There was that run. He had another run cut short, obviously, when he was with the Spurs, the one that basically led to him leaving the Spurs. And before that, we were watching him pre-prime with the Spurs as a second guy, you know, a third guy sometimes. So I'd like to see more of him. Just, you know, could he lead a team? Could he lead a team with Paul George to that level to win another title? And it kind of sucks to not be able to answer that question.
LeBron was a great answer. Jokic and Kawhi are obvious answers for me. I mean, Ja Morant is really easy. That kind of just popped into my head just because he's the most entertaining player in the league and he's not playing anymore, really. My number one favorite player to watch is Zion Williamson. I don't know how realistic it would be to have him be in a second round of a postseason, but maybe we'll get him there next year.
Maybe.
In terms of forgotten superstars, I feel like no one is thinking about talking about Damian Lillard. Damian Lillard in the playoffs is unbelievable. Very, very fun.
Good call.
I missed him. That's about, I mean, there's a lot of guys. Like, I really enjoyed watching Anthony Edwards in the first round. He is going to be on this stage very, very soon. He's amazing. I miss watching him play. A lot of guys. Like, I could go on and on and on and on forever. Bruce Brown, just a true joy. Great at what he does. That was a joke. Chris, you can laugh. It's okay.
I was like, am I... Yeah, like, yeah, I thought I misheard that for a minute. I'm like, did I miss something? Okay, got you. The Dame answer is a really good call. Zion and Ja, to some extent, like, Ja's already given me and other people just so much playoff joy from an enjoyment standpoint. Zion, like, they're so young now. I don't want to take Zion for granted because we've seen guys. Greg Oden obviously comes to mind as a guy that's a little bit drastic, but a guy that, you know, just never got right physically. So you don't want to take it for granted necessarily, but I feel like we'll get chances to see them hopefully and a lot more of them. But yeah, Dame is when you just talk about guys that are super fun to watch in that setting. I forgot about that one. That's one I forgot about for sure.
Well, Chris, I think that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you so much for your insight, your knowledge. Thank you so much to the Open Floor Globe for your wonderful emails. Please keep them coming. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Everyone stay safe. Everyone please continue to enjoy these wonderful NBA playoffs.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.